This year marks the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty. And all this year, we've been taking a look at how the face of American poverty is changing. And we've been talking about whether our national conversation about poverty matches the reality. Today, we want to take a look at how African Americans and whites may experience poverty differently, even when they live essentially side by side in the same city. A group of researchers followed hundreds of poor children in Baltimore for more than 25 years and found race, more than substance abuse, education, or criminal history, determined their access to economic opportunity. That research is the centerpiece of the new book, The Long Shadow: Family Background, Disadvantaged Urban Youth, and the Transition to Adulthood. The book's findings are already getting a lot of attention, so we've called Carl Alexander, one of the researchers and a professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Alexander, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Also with us for additional perspective is writer Dee Watkins. He's an adjunct professor at Coppin State University, and he's written extensively about growing up poor and black in Baltimore. Professor Watkins, thank you also for joining us.
Thank you. How's everything?
Great. So, Professor Alexander, let me start with you. The study followed 800 children for decades of their lives. It's an unusually long period of study. What were you looking for? What motivated this to begin with?
Well, we refer to the project as the Beginning School Study. The intuition at the time was that if getting off to a bumpy start would not augur well for what follows, and getting off to a smooth transition in first grade would smooth the skids all the way along. And in fact, we did that. But then when we got into it, we realized that we had really set the stage for something that would be more ambitious. And so we decided to stay with it a bit longer.
Now, about 40% of the children you studied were white. The rest were African American. Did you think that race would play a part in your findings from the beginning?
Oh, we absolutely did. The project took a somewhat surprising turn when we looked at some of the information we got from these our study youngsters when they had exited high school at age 22 and 28. One of the things that was so striking in our initial review of our findings was that hardly any of these children who grew up in difficult low-income family circumstances were successful in completing college. So at age 28, the last time we spoke with them, only 4% of the children we call urban disadvantaged had a baccalaureate degree, and even fewer of these youngsters had attained an associate arts degree, a two-year degree. So not many of the urban disadvantaged in the experiences of our youngsters were moving up in life through the mechanisms that we encourage them to focus in on. You know, mm-hmm. Do well at school, play by the rules, do what your teachers tell you, and good things will happen. Well, a lot of them played by the rules and did the right things, but the good things didn't follow.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about different outcomes for poor whites and blacks based on a 25-year study that took place in Baltimore. Our guests are Professor Carl Alexander, one of the researchers in the study, and also Dee Watkins, who's an adjunct professor and also a writer who grew up in Baltimore, which is where the study took place. So Dee Watkins, let me hear from you. Did when you were growing up, did you know white people growing up? I think a lot of people have this idea that, you know, people in a lot of urban areas live largely segregated lives. They don't really know anybody who's of a different background or a different race. Did you know white people growing up, and did you see their lives as different from yours?
Housing police and some school teachers. I didn't really know. Like, all of my schools were all black. The people who I know who went to church went to all black churches. I've played sports in all black rec centers. I really didn't meet or have any personal relationships with white people until I got into college, other than like a few teachers that were like that I had a connection with coming up.
Do you remember ever wondering about white people or whether their lives were different from yours?
You know, you think that, you know, what you get is from, you know, like music and television. So, you know, you think like, well, every white person lives like that show in the Wonder Years. Well, it's not something that I spent a lot of time thinking about as a kid, but, you know, just looking back in retrospect and, you know, then talking about some of the things I write about, the part of Baltimore I grew up in is extremely segregated, and you're not going to come across too many white people coming up.
Well, Professor Alexander, I think one of the points that the study makes very bluntly is that poor white poverty, particularly in an urban area, gets disappeared somehow. Right?
Yeah,
why is that, by the way?
Well, that's exactly right. I think if your understanding of what cities like Baltimore is like comes from the media, it's quite clear. You'd think that the issue of urban poverty is an issue of African American poor, but in point of fact, there are pockets of white poverty scattered all throughout Baltimore. low-income whites and low-income blacks live substantially segregated lives owing to residential segregation. So they live in parallel, but poor whites are there. And one of the interesting patterns that we observed as we tried to make sense out of the experiences of the youngsters in our study group was that poor white men especially, were much more successful in the labor market, despite not being particularly successful in school. That is, the poor white men had the lowest average level of completed schooling of any of the groups we compared, but they had the highest earnings and they had the most steady employment over the years after high school.
So everybody who was low income had a hard time accessing higher education. So that was one of the findings.
That's absolutely true.
But poor white men who didn't finish high school had far better employment prospects than poor black men who didn't finish high school. Why is that?
The key to this difference is access to high pay, high skill work in the blue collar workforce. And in the main, it's the remnants of Baltimore's industrial economy is where it stands out in the experiences of these study youngsters. 45% of the white men of working class background at age 28 were employed in the industrial and construction crafts. So they were plumbers, electricians, mechanics, welders, brick masons. People have the idea that with deindustrialization, those kinds of positions have just disappeared from the map. And it's certainly the case that there are fewer jobs of that sort in the industrial economy, in the urban industrial economy. And of those employed in that sector, the whites were earning double what the African-American men were earning. So there is a decided pattern of what we call white privilege or white advantage that presents itself in accessing high pay, steady work in the non-college
labor
market.
And how did they get those jobs? You asked them, how did you get that job? What did they say?
Well, we did ask them straight out at age 22. We said, how did you get your current job? And whites much more often said through family and friends, and African Americans much more often said on their own. So we think the story here revolves substantially around social networks that are advantageous for some and lacking for others.
So let me ask Dee Watkins about that. So Dee, how did you... Tell me about when you were growing up, what did you think you were going to be doing when you became a grown-up? Do you remember thinking about it? What did you want to do? What did you think you were going to be doing?
I wanted to play basketball.
So did I.
Well, yeah, me too.
I wanted to play basketball, and then I had a doctor phase, I had a lawyer phase. I wanted to be all of these different things, but I ended up outside like everyone else. And it's crazy just listening to this because the things that are in Carl's study, it's the things that everyone says, but, you know, it's there's always that other side that can argue this and argue that, but he put down the cold hard facts. Like, they put down the cold hard facts. So now, you know, the things that we say are now confirmed through this study and undeniable. You know, I don't know too many people who can say, hey, you know, my uncle has a plumbing company. We'll teach you the trade. We'll bring you in as an apprentice and, you know, we'll help you out, or electricians and things like that. So, no, I wanted to go to college. I wanted to play basketball, but you know, and I started out on that path, and then I just went in a different direction.
So, did you know anybody in your life growing up, among, as you said, in an African American environment, like really not knowing any white people except for the housing police and teachers, who got a job through relatives?
Yeah, but it's not common.
So, Professor Alexander, we're down to our last, you know, couple of minutes here, and I wanted to hear some. What are the policy implications of this? I mean, how would you like this to inform the way we think about this whole issue now?
You can enforce equal employment opportunity laws and things of that sort, and absolutely we should. But that doesn't speak to the advantages that come through just being in the right place at the right time and knowing the right kinds of people. So I don't have an easy answer, I'm afraid to say. But I think we have an understanding of the issue, and perhaps people who do work on policy and are more clever than I can figure out some approaches.
I gotcha. Dee Watkins, a final thought from you. Knowing what you know now about how things work, and I am mindful that I heard you say this was the kind of thing that you always talked about or that you heard about or that was rumored, but that you never really knew was true. Now that you know that the networks do make a difference, do you have any thoughts about what would have made a difference for you?
What I would say is if we all just, you know, from the black side, we just had the ability to reach out and connect more with the other side. And, you know, hopefully the city will be less segregated one day. But even, you know, if it doesn't go in that direction, open up these networks. Get some of these trade jobs because they're out there and learn these skills. And just expose young people to more things because, you know, like we talked about, college is just not going to work for everyone.
Do you have time for me to just jump in and add to that?
Because very briefly. Yeah, that has to be your final thought.
It turns out white men have the highest rate in our group, have the highest rates of binge drinking, marijuana use, and heavy drug use, and have arrest records that are comparable to the African-American men. So lots of young people in places like Baltimore take a misstep along the way. What's so striking is that white men's employment prospects aren't nearly as impaired by, you know, that profile as our white men, so as our African-American men's employment prospects. So if a young African-American man gets in trouble with the law or drops out of high school, that really does pose barriers for his getting good access to good paying, steady work. For white men, it's not so much the case.
Important information. That was Professor Carl Alexander joining us from the studios at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore. Dee Watkins is with us. He's a writer and adjunct professor at Coppin State University. He joined us from member station WYPR in Baltimore. Obviously, there's a lot to talk about here, and so I hope we'll continue to talk about this. Will be the first conversation and not the last conversation. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.